Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me with the Relax Back UK show this week. The first topic is hearing, and I talk with audiologist Annie Morris about all aspects, including what might cause hearing loss in the first place.
There's so many different risk factors that trigger the onset of a hearing loss, and it can happen at any age, from environmental, sometimes as a result of illness, medication, all sorts of things.
Then what gruesome thing has been talked about here?
It's a tropical infectious parasitic disease. So it's transmitted by Plasmodium parasites, and it's transmitted by the infectious bite from a female infected Anopheles mosquito.
It is malaria, which is a major concern for much of the world, and my guest is Dr. Rinky Deb. Before moving on, I want to remind you about the book that I've just published. It's called Cut the Crap, Ask the Questions That Matter About Your Health. It has health answers from expert guests to the show and encourages everyone to ask questions about their health. So please do stay tuned for a great show. Thank you.
This show is cool!
So let's move straight on with my first guest, Annie Morris, who, as we'll hear a few times, is an audiologist.
So my guest today is Annie Morris, and she's an audiologist, and I had to practice saying that a couple of times. I think I did it quite well. I'm going to say it again, audiologist.
Fantastic.
Right, so maybe first question's got to be, what is an audiologist anyway?
So an audiologist is a health professional that looks after a person's hearing health. Also includes things like balance testing, tinnitus, if you've heard that phrase before, and paediatric hearing assessments as well.
Okay, so there's quite a lot to it. It's not just kind of saying, oi, and seeing if people hear it.
I mean, we can try with that. We start there and then go on from that point. But our ears are very small and complex. So, there's lots more to it than just our hearing.
All right. So how do you check? Let's stay with hearing for the time being.
Of course.
How do you check someone's hearing in a slightly more sophisticated way than just going, oi, over here?
So in an assessment, we tend to go through a couple of stages. So first of all is a procedure called otoscopy, and that is where we examine the health of the external and external ear. So up until your eardrum, we make sure that there's nothing that shouldn't be there, and that it's nice and healthy. And then we'll complete something called a pure tone audiogram. And that is where a person will have some headphones over their ears, will present some tones to them, and then they press a button in response to the quietest sound that they can hear. And sometimes then we go on to doing some speech testing and being able to make an assessment then on a person's hearing ability.
Okay. So it's, in general terms, is hearing loss a big problem? In the UK, but kind of the world over. So I'm 58 now. Am I likely to have lost a lot of my hearing ability?
There's so many different risk factors that trigger the onset of a hearing loss, and it can happen at any age, from environmental, sometimes as a result of illness, medication, all sorts of things. So there isn't a set time where a hearing loss can happen. However, we are more susceptible for hearing changes as we get older and as our hearing system becomes less sensitive to sounds. So that's why we always say at the age of about 50, it's worth to have a check to make sure that nothing has happened. But often hearing is insidious. It happens very slowly over time. We don't even notice it's occurring until it has more significant impact. So it can start with, I've missed the bell on my microwave going off, for example, and something that's not specifically important, to I'm really having difficulty in noise in groups, hearing my family and friends. So there's a whole range, but often it starts with the things that aren't necessarily important to us.
Okay. When I was 17, I went to a concert of the Thompson Twins, which was great. But my ears were actually ringing for 3 days afterwards. Could I be feeling the significance of that now? It was a long time ago.
If it's something that is reoccurring, so if you are in those noisy environments very regularly, it can have a impact to our hearing. And sometimes when we're in those environments, a process called a temporary threshold shift happens. And basically, our ears go into defense mode. It loses some energy, so it lowers your hearing to protect itself. Over time, 24 hours, that restores back to normal. If we're in those noisy environments very often, that threshold becomes less temporary and more permanent. So that then deteriorates. So a significant amount of time in those environments would definitely have an impact at some point.
Okay, but a one-off concert, probably not too bad.
Not too bad, but we would encourage some hearing protection in that environment because only a small amount of time in that noise can have some form of impact on your hearing long-term.
Right. I have teenage children and I find myself constantly telling them to enunciate, please. So do teenage children just mumble or is there something else going on?
I think that's a million-pound question. I think there is probably a case for both where a teenager will not want to speak to everyone and mumble a little bit and sometimes can be a sign of not hearing as clearly. It's probably a mix, but if there was any concern, we'd probably encourage you to have a hearing check just to make sure nothing else is happening.
Yeah, well, actually, I'll tell you a story. My wife went to have a hearing check because she was having this issue, you know, with our 14-year-old boy, actually. And so she went to have a hearing check and was told everything was fine. So she had this piece of paper and she waved it in front of it and said, speak clearly.
I think we often have that when people hope that would be the result that they can take home to go, there's nothing wrong with my hearing, it's you speaking. But sometimes it's not always the case.
No. All right. So on a slightly more sort of serious point, lots of people do suffer from loss of hearing. Actually, what is the percentage? How many people do we know?
So at the moment in the UK, we're saying about 18 million people in the UK have a hearing loss, whether treated or untreated. And by treated, we mean we're providing some support for their hearing through a hearing aid or a hearing assistive device.
So that's a lot. So out of a population of 70 million or so, 18 million, this is a big percentage. You know, it's getting on for a third of us.
Yes. Yes, it is. And, you know, we are living longer. And we are an aging population as well. So the levels of people with experiencing hearing loss are probably set to rise over the next 20 years. We want people to age with the term successfully and healthily. So addressing any concerns as early a time as possible is really important.
Okay. Now, what about issues at work? Because a lot of people at work need to talk to people. You know, communication is a large part of what a lot of people do at work. And if your hearing goes, you know, you work on the phone all day or even interviewing people all day on Zoom, whatever it might be, it can potentially be an issue.
Yes. Yeah.
Can you help these people?
Definitely. I think if there are any concerns, the first step we would say is let's talk to an audiology professional. Let's see if there is an underlying hearing loss. Sometimes it can just be the environment that we're working in. We're constantly in noise. We're constantly busy. We're trying to do 50 million things at once. And sometimes there are some easy, small steps that can be taken to reduce the impact any hearing loss can have. So for example, in an office, if the meeting is being held around other people chatting away on the phone, for example, it's just moving that meeting into a slightly quieter environment to help that person hear a little bit better. So they are often very easy steps to take, but we just aren't aware of them. And we just want to raise that awareness.
Okay. Something that kind of happens to me quite often, If you're talking to someone on the phone and they're in a noisy place and it sounds like they're on speakerphone, I don't know if they are or not, but I suspect they might well be because it's just easier to use a speakerphone quite often.
Yeah.
All this other noise comes in and I find it really difficult to hear what they're saying. Is that a common complaint?
It's probably one of the most common complaints and probably the activity that triggers someone to go, I need to do something about my hearing. If we go back to when we used to be around dinosaurs, quite a long time ago, our hearing was developed as a fight or flight instinct. So it wanted to tell us.
I'm not sure we were ever around dinosaurs. I don't think we coexisted. Maybe the odd woolly mammoth.
Mammoth, maybe. Let's go mammoth then. So we wanted to make sure that we weren't being chased by a mammoth. Our hearing is a fight or flight instinct. Predominantly, that's why it was developed. And actually, when we're in a noisy environment, our brain is constantly searching those noises for anything that causes danger to us. So sometimes it can distract away from the conversation that we're having because it just wants to make sure that we are safe. So that's why it can cause a problem.
What about hearing aids? Because I have noticed some of them, actually, they're pretty small now.
Yeah, the technology in the last 10 years in hearing aid has been incredible, with some of the most latest models containing AI to be able to understand the environment around you to give you the best outcome. Some of the traditional, beige hearing aids that people always used to associate with hearing aids, they just don't exist any longer. They're very small, even behind the ear. They're rechargeable. They can stream your Bluetooth, stream things from your phone. They're super technologically advanced now and really great to use.
So they help a lot of people in the work environment, or all environments, I'm assuming.
Yeah, definitely. And just having an app on your phone that can adjust and make changes to your hearing aid settings depending on your environment. We're all on apps for various things, so it doesn't pull attention to someone having a hearing aid, which helps with that stigma that we do find with hearing loss.
Okay. I'm going to ask you in a moment if people are sort of concerned about this, or thinking, oh God, I'm not sure if my hearing's are what they can do and a good resource to go to. But before that, I want to ask a very selfish question. At the start, you said audiologists deal with balance. That's one of the things you do. In the last year or so, I have started to, I'm not sure why I'm telling you this. This is really quite personal. But anyway, when I'm brushing my teeth, I do the 30 seconds a quarter,
Yes.
and I stand on one leg for one quarter. And then the next quarter, I stand on the same leg and shut my eyes.
Right.
And the idea behind this, I'm sure I think I heard this on Just One Thing on the radio with, I can't remember. But anyway, that's what I'm doing. And I do that with my eyes open, my eyes shut on both sides. Is that likely to develop my balance, or is it just a bonkers thing to do?
So our balance comes from three centers. So our feet, our eyes, and our ears. And how the information they give us tell us where we are for the away from the floor, where our head is in space, and where our head is from our shoulders. So actually, they all need to work together to give us good balance. But closing our eyes, for example, takes away one of those measures of balance, and actually just make is a good check to see that everything else is working. So is my foot detecting the floor well, and is my ears detecting my head to my shoulders well? And if we're remaining still, it's a good sign.
It is really difficult with your eyes shut.
It is very difficult.
I can only do a few seconds before I sort of have to grab onto the sink.
Yeah, we're designed to have all three working together as best as possible.
All right. Enough about me and my bizarre issues. Let's move on to is so if people want some information or a good resource about hearing loss and possibly balance as well, where can they go? What can they have a look at? Probably a good website, something like that.
Yeah, so if they search It's Time to Talk About Hearing, they'll be able to see the hearing health report that Specsavers launched this year that has all these this information in there, along with some key facts and key resources as to what to do if there's any concerns. But if someone is having concerns about their hearing, they can pop into a Specsavers store, book online, do our online test even, just to check that there's any issues with their hearing. And if they come into store, they'll be able to be seen by one of our expert audiologists who will be able to guide them through the next steps for them.
Good. All right. I think that sounds like potentially very useful for a lot of people. As you mentioned, a lot of people suffer from this. So, Annie, many thanks for chatting.
Thank you very much.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Dr. Rinky Deb is a malaria expert, and she works with Vestergaard, who make mosquito nets. My first question to her was, how many people suffer worldwide from malaria?
If we look at the 2023 malaria report, and that's based on cases that have been reported in 2022, so it's always working on data from the previous year, there are 249 million cases of malaria, of which 608,000 malaria deaths occurred across 85 countries across the world. So that's a bit of a backdrop to the malaria concern, as it were.
So that's a lot of people. I'm sure there's kind of a gruesome top 10 list of killers. Where does it come in that list?
Yeah, no, I think it comes within the top three. primarily because it affects so many children under five, and pregnant women. It affects the economic ability for people. So, for example, if you've got malaria, that you can't go to work, and the absenteeism. So, yeah, it's quite a devastating disease.
Okay, so a lot of people, a lot of us Brits, if we haven't travelled, we won't actually really know what it is. I'm sure most people have heard of it, but kind of, what is it? What are the symptoms? What does it do to you?
Yeah, sure. So it's a tropical infectious parasitic disease. So it's transmitted by Plasmodium parasites, and it's transmitted by the infectious bite from a female infected Anopheles mosquito. And every bite from an infected mosquito can translate in infection. So as you can imagine, the spread of malaria can be very rapid, and left untreated, it could be obviously deadly. The primary symptoms that people think about when, and this is more related to people in those endemic areas, it's if you've got a high fever and severe headaches, chills, then you need to go and get yourself tested for malaria. So for the average Brit, it's probably not symptoms that you would be so familiar with, but the headache is on another level, I guess. I've never compared migraine to malaria headache, but I think it would be probably in that sort of spectrum of quite debilitating headaches and fever at high levels that are not coming down unless you're treating the actual disease.
All right, so when you've got it, you really know it.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, and so you say it's a parasitic disease. So you get bitten by the mosquito, and that has, when it bites you, it passes on effectively little animals, little parasites.
Yes.
And do they continue to develop once they're in your bloodstream, or what happens?
Yeah, so I mean, the life cycle of the parasite is a mixture of the human and taking the blood meal, and parasites developing within the human, within the liver, and then also there are development stages within the mosquito. So one can't exist without the other. You can't have, for example, if you don't have any mosquitoes, you can't complete the transmission cycle for malaria, and equally, I don't want to say this. Yeah, so if there's no humans, for example, then equally the malaria parasites can't complete its transmission cycle. There are some places where mosquitoes will take blood meals from animals, for example, but the transmission cycle that we're worried about is human to parasite, right. Mosquito.
Is it actually a different sort of malaria that might affect animals to humans?
There are different species. There are particular species that are primarily associated with, for example, animals that you would find, for example, rats. I think there is a Plasmodium bergii, and so those ones are not problematic for humans. But there are some, for example, Plasmodium knowlesii, which used to be in non-human primates, and then have now been able to, there has been transfer, and you can see very low numbers, but there are cases where transmission can happen.
Right. So there are actually quite a few different types of malaria. Do you know how many there are?
Yeah, so you've got Plasmodium falciparum, which is the primary strain and the one that's causing the most deaths. You've got Plasmodium ovale, vivax, and malaria. So those are the four. When people talk about malaria, they talk about those four species. But as I said, Plasmodium falciparum is the main species that is the most worrying.
Okay. All right. Now, anyone who's gone on holiday, certainly to Scotland, in fact, most parts of the UK, if they're camping or hiking, will know full well that there are plenty of mosquitoes that will find you and bite you. How come there's not really malaria in the UK? We've got plenty of mosquitoes and plenty of people.
Yeah, definitely. So I think it's worth bearing in mind that it's only one particular family of mosquitoes. It's only Anopheles mosquitoes that are able to transmit malaria. I think a lot of the mosquitoes that are being that are biting people when you're camping in Scotland, to your example, they might be culicines, or they might be other species that are not malaria transmitters. That said, though, climate change is playing a big role in enabling malaria to not just be a focalized disease in areas like South America or Africa or you know, continent of Asia. So, for example, we do see a few, but not in the levels that you would consider a public health problem, cases across Europe, for example, and that is due to travel, economic movement of people and just the world that we live in today. Yeah.
Okay. Well, so that leads on to kind of an interesting question. Could potentially, is malaria creeping up from, you know, Southern Europe, where there are also plenty of mosquitoes? And is there a situation where actually it could get a bit closer to us or even end up here?
We're not at the stage where malaria is a public health problem in the UK. I think that there are very few cases that are detected, but they are usually from people that are travelling to areas and have contracted the disease whilst they're out there and to come back with symptoms. That said, as I said before about climate change, in the future, if we didn't do anything about it, it would potentially create the environment where you could see malaria in areas where it wasn't found before.
Actually, I must admit, I did a little bit of digging before our chat, and I know a little knowledge is a very dangerous thing. But I saw this extraordinary example, actually, from the First World War, when a lot of troops came from the Balkans, where malaria was endemic. And then they were stationed in the Isle of Sheppey, which was very marshy, and there were a lot of mosquitoes. And they sort of had this localised problem of malaria. So a lot of the troops caught it elsewhere abroad and then started to feel the effects here, and actually some of it was passed on to locals at that time. I think
we're today in a very privileged position in that we, whilst no healthcare system is perfect, but we do have a stronger healthcare infrastructure than, for example, countries in Africa, where if it did become an emerging threat, that there would be quite rapid and immediate reaction to that to ensure that malaria didn't become a larger public health problem. I mean, thinking about that example a long time ago, diagnostics and so forth weren't quite as advanced as they are today. And so we've got a lot of tools in the toolbox to ensure that we can detect, prevent, cure, all sorts, all the different interventions you want to have for ensuring malaria can be eliminated.
Yeah. All right. What about in places where, it is a problem? And it is a public health issue. What kind of things do people do, the governments try and make happen because this kills thousands of people. What happens to try and sort of mitigate the effects?
Yeah, so there is a clear program as I mentioned before, there's a toolbox, so a suite of tools that we use to try and combat and eliminate malaria. So if you think about from the first stages that you want to prevent getting malaria overall, so there's a number of prevention tools out there. I work for Vestergaard, which is a net manufacturer, and we produce bed nets, and they are insecticide treated. They are there to kill the mosquito and to prevent and to cut down and break down that malaria transmission cycle. But there are other tools out there as well.
So you're just talking, avoid getting bitten in the first place.
Yes, exactly. And then the other side of it is preventative chemotherapies. So, for example, certain times of the year when there's malaria being transmitted, people are getting medication as well to avoid themselves getting the infected with malaria. We've got the vaccine that's recently come out, not the silver bullet, but it's a new tool, and it's welcomed into the fight. But then also, if you've got malaria, you've got to have the right diagnostics in place and then have the therapeutics. And unfortunately, what we're seeing though is that both with the vector side and so vector control methods and with the drugs, we are seeing drug resistance and insecticide resistance, which is a problem and a hurdle that we're trying to get over together.
You mentioned a drug just before the vaccine. You mentioned a drug that people can take to prevent getting bitten.
No, it's an anti-malarial medicine that you take during times of high transmission, so that you wouldn't get malaria in that time. So it's an intervention called seasonal malaria chemotherapy.
Because I've heard, this is very anecdotal, of people taking things. I think it was garlic pills to try and stop mosquitoes biting you in the first place. So if, you know, if mosquitoes don't like garlic, I can't imagine that working. But over to you. Do such things exist?
I think that some of that that evidence is yet to be proven. It's definitely not one of the interventions that I'd be putting my money on, that we need to all have more garlic. They may have health benefits to it, but
it
from a malaria
benefits,
malaria perspective, I wouldn't say that additional garlic will stop you from being bitten. Yeah. I mean, when I was a student and learning about malaria, they said something about cheesy feet and mosquitoes were attracted to cheesy feet. That is a core example, but it's not something that you would say that stands true to everybody. And yeah.
Okay. I mean, what they used to do, they would, in the good old days, they just blast everything with DDT, which is actually pretty effective, I think, as far as stopping malaria. But produce lots of other issues. You know, DDT is highly toxic to us as well, all sorts of other things. Now, you've mentioned insecticides, and in fact, treating bed nets with insecticides. Presumably the technology has moved on somewhat.
So indoor residual spraying, which is how DDT was used, so that meant that people went into somebody's house and they would spray all of their walls with DDT. And that's how it was done with DDT. It is still an intervention that is that has evidence to support it as a way of controlling the vector. But we've moved away from DDT. We're not using DDT anymore. We are using other active ingredients, whether it be on bed nets or whether it be on indoor residual spraying or larviciding, for example, which are not so detrimental to health and the environment. So at the moment we have a net that is pyrethroid, so deltamethrin, and another insecticide called chlorpheniper, so two AIs, and it's got a dual active action to it, so that it can have a two-pronged approach at making sure the mosquito dies. If it's not dying with the first insecticide, it will die with the second. So there, some of the interventions that you're talking about, they've been around for a long time. They've achieved a lot, but insecticide resistance is a big problem.
I haven't heard of insecticide resistance, but me. So how quickly does this resistance kind of show itself? Can these sneaky little mosquitoes develop it, you know, in a season?
No, not quite so quickly. I think that it's important to remember that insecticide resistance, as with any resistance, is continual exposure to suboptimal levels that you're meant to have be exposed to. So, for example, if we use the example of indoor residual spraying and DDT, there was a lot of DDT being sprayed, but it wasn't always at the level that would have killed the mosquito. So we had a lot of gains in the 1940s with insecticides, but then we've also had evolution in mosquitoes as we evolve ourselves as well. Evolution of mosquitoes, and therefore the mode of action for the insecticide has become less effective or ineffective. And that's been a continual problem. So we had DDT, then we had pyrethroids, which had a similar mode of action as DDT. Really, we put a lot of emphasis on stewarding the new insecticides that are coming out for public health use to ensure that they can, for example, what's happened in the past, where and they have emerged just as part of biology.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with all that in mind, vaccines sounds potentially a better way to go.
I think that, yes, vaccines have a place in malaria elimination, but it is a suite of tools that we're using. The malaria vaccines that are out there are not silver bullets. So they are not 100% protective. They won't end malaria. So you need to continue whilst innovation is still happening in that vaccine space. You've got to carry on with other tools such as preventive chemotherapy, such as, you know, vector control as well. I hope that we do get closer to being able to protect through vaccines, but we're just not there yet.
And is innovation still happening? You know, it's because in the media, you hear a lot about how, you know, various diseases are not first world problems, therefore they don't get as much research or as much money thrown at them. I can imagine malaria might fall into that category. What are your thoughts?
So I did a quick search recently have a look at the UK Research and Innovation website to see how much money, if you put in, if you go onto their website, you can put in malaria, and it tells you all of the grants that have been funding malaria related research. And it's actually quite sizable. So over the last 10 years, they've made 160 awards, ranging from somewhere in the region of £66,000 to £4.3 million. So that's quite a sizable investment in that. And the major funders for research, such as Wellcome Trust, the Medical Research Council, the Biotechnology and Biological Sciences Research Council, they are all investing in good quality research to ensure that we are also key players in being able to understand how to eliminate malaria. So whilst you may feel that you don't hear so much about it, there is a lot going on in the UK and a lot of leaders in the UK that are pushing good research out there. I mean, Mike, when we first started, you said, oh, am I associated with an academic facility? I'm not, but I am both. We have two tropical schools in the UK. I'm very privileged to have attended both. So the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, the Liverpool School of Hygiene, Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine, both places are very invested in ensuring not only early research, but also translational research to make sure it has the biggest impact. And I'm not going to stop with those two only. There's a lot of great work going on at Oxford, Imperial, Glasgow. There's a lot of universities across the UK that are investing in research for
actually,
malaria.
Many years ago, my wife used to work at Imperial. She's a scientist. She doesn't specialise in malaria, but she had a job for a couple of years as a lab tech. And this was in the malaria research department.
Oh, lovely. Yeah.
I remember her telling me a great story. Probably shouldn't say this really, but they would move mosquitoes from lab to lab occasionally, and they would be given a container with mosquitoes in it, and they would go on the tube, and they would be given a spray can of insecticide should any of them break out. Yes, because I can imagine down on the underground, they might like it down there. It's kind of warm. They could do all right. And these were malarial mosquitoes.
Right, of course. Yeah, of course. So, I mean, health and safety and ethics is a bit stronger, I think, nowadays.
Yeah,
so it's not so
ago.
Easy. Yeah, it's not so easy nowadays. I think that you have to get a lot of ethical clearance nowadays to move mosquitoes. And definitely there is a general push within academic institutions, for example, that have resistant strains in the UK. They're not willing to pass them back into African countries for research, for example, because you don't want to reintroduce highly resistant mosquitoes into an environment that's already quite difficult to tackle malaria.
But anyway, essentially, there is research happening, and the research environment is alive and well.
Yes.
The figures you sent that you mentioned that have been invested seem quite high.
Yes.
Although modern research is extraordinarily expensive. It remains to be seen whether it's enough, I suppose.
There was a stat that came out, I think, relatively recently. So globally, 1% of R&D health funding goes towards developing new tools to combat malaria, of which only 6% goes towards malaria R&D. And so it's a in vector control. So it's a difficult landscape. It's a competitive landscape. And I mean, I've mentioned the UK funders. There are, it would be a disservice not to mention, for example, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and they invest quite a lot in malaria research. And that is, some of these universities, such as Imperial that you mentioned, they have received BMGF funding as well. So there are outside funders that support it. But there's still a lot to be done. And whilst evolution continues, what you think is a status quo may not be the case in a few years' time as well.
Sure. All right, let me finish with a couple of questions more on getting more information, really. If people have been listening to this and thinking, this is interesting stuff, I would like to find out some more. They might not be a scientist, but so they're looking for information that is accessible to all. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know where people could find something like that. And also, if someone wants a scientific career and thinking, actually, I would like to do something in this world, in the world of malaria, that is useful, for mankind. Any advice for them? So two questions.
Yeah, sure. So for finding out more information about malaria in the UK, there's an organisation called Malaria No More, and I think they put out a lot of good literature out there for the UK audience, but also global audience, to understand about the impact of malaria. There is always the World Health Organization, so if you go onto their website and pop in malaria, you'll be able to get some fact sheets that really do make sure it's information that anybody can access and understand. But also you could get, for example, the annual malaria report, which updates you on the progresses that were made last year, and you can go back a number of years. And on top of that, you can also, if you're really that interested, you could find out what the guidelines are for countries and what interventions they're using and how they're meant to be using it. So there's a variety of different resources out there. Places like the BBC and the Guardian, I'm sure you can search those sort of sources as well. But yeah, my go-to would probably be the World Health Organization and Malaria No More. And for people that want to pursue a career in, when you said that, it was a bit of a difficult question for me, because the malaria community is not just made up of researchers. It's made up of people that are making procurement decisions, that are, business analysts and whatnot as well. So if I can reflect on my own career, so I started off with a molecular biology degree, and I made sure that I was, I had the pleasure of studying and doing my master's at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and then moved on to do my PhD also at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. So that pathway is one of the pathways you could pursue. But making sure that you have a good biology background, and then being able to be involved in those projects that are relevant and support you. So there's a lot of translation as well. So you don't always have to have worked on malaria. Actually, my PhD was on a different parasitic disease, but the knowledge is transferable to malaria. So yeah, I hope that piques some people's interests, and they'll continue to search more on careers in.
No, I'm sure it will. So yes, that's excellent. So look, Rinky, thank you so much for taking the time to chat today. This is interesting and, very important stuff. So thank you.
Thanks, Mike, for having me.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show. And they were Annie Morris. She's an audiologist with Specsavers, and she was talking about hearing loss. And then Dr. Rinky Deb, she's an expert on malaria with Vestergaard, talking about malaria worldwide. And of course, a big thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.